Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So it seems if we read the suttas that in the Buddha's day, then there are a lot of spiritual seekers of all kinds drifting about with quite clear views about what they saw as the way things work, why the universe is. So in some ways this is similar these days, in other ways different, I think. In those days, then, the scientific view of things didn't hold so much sway, and so there were views of the universe of the world which would be contrary to that. But also, then also, there'd be views which were just about the mind, and spiritual views is the same as today, really different religions, so to speak. They're quite well articulated views that would debate with each other. And you see how in the suttas, over and over again, the Buddha is debating with such people, and then it was presented as his kind of triumph. So he's a great winner of debates. Drawing people over to his view. So whether we call this converting people to Buddhism, I don't really know, but certainly drawing practitioners into his view of practice, because the Buddha, after all, puts forward a path of inquiry rather than a doctrine. A way of looking rather than a doctrine, although he states clearly what is seen by somebody who sees clearly. Somebody who sees clearly sees this. So this is a bit different, isn't it, from a doctrinal argument, debate. What he's saying is a bit different to that. So if somebody sees not just with the intellect or through belief, but they realise something. They realise the deathless. They see something that goes beyond birth and death. They see that, then this changes their whole perception of the process of birth and death. So I think if we put it like that, then it's quite clear that if one sees something that's past the grave, then it would change our view of everything. And then we see what that is, that exists. Buddha says if you can see this, then this would change everything else. It would change our view of the world, and the things in the world, and our relationship between the body and the spirit, say, body and soul. So this is the kind of crux of it, and then in the old days, then there would be two kinds of views: the eternalist view, which is that the mind just survives the body intact and just goes from one, and there's an essence to the mind which just carries on one birth to another, reincarnation. And then there's a view that the body is dependent upon the body, which is another, the opposing view, materialist view. And then the Buddha's teaching is in the middle between these two. It's neither of those things. So we have to be careful of this. We can come from a material view, materialist view, a scientific understanding of the world, almost taken for granted these days. Then we think that we can maybe open this up or go a bit beyond this to suggest that the mind may be able to survive the body in some way or other. When we do that, we can just fall straight into the opposite view, that there's an essence to the mind, an eternal soul, eternal spirit. And yeah, the Buddha doesn't state this either. This can seem confusing, but if we think of that, the one view is that there is something that is born that never dies. This would be the eternalist view, and the material view would be that there's something that everything that's born dies. This is materialist view, and then the Buddhist view is that there is something that what is never born, or there is something that is never born, that never dies. And what is born that dies, but there is something, and the Buddha describes and defines this and shows her way to find it. There is something that doesn't get born and that doesn't die. To me, that's the clearest description of this thing, the deathless Amata Dhamma. What is it that doesn't get born, the uncreated, the unformed? So this we can relate to here in our own experience. We do relate to it, you know. We do have a stand there somewhere. You know, even if we're not a philosopher or a mystic, you know, we do have a stand there. If we look closely at our attitudes, underlying attitude to life, then we are taking a stand. We have a stand. We'd be living according to one of these kinds of ideas. We'd be living in a way that is consistent with an understanding, even if we don't really articulate it or think about it very much. So maybe live in just a material way, looking to get what we can, enjoy life as we can until the final curtain. And that's the priority. We don't really think of anything else. We don't consider, have never seen any other kind of possibility. So we just, this is what we have, that's all we can see. So we could just see what we want in life and enjoy what we can, the best we can, while we can. Or this can be positive or negative, actually. You know, we can just kind of stay out of trouble as best we can. Stay out of the trouble of the material world as best we can. The difficulty of it. Look after ourselves, shelter ourselves as best we can from the adversity of it. Either way. And then there's a mind that is less involved with the things of the world. That's open to the possibility or has a sense for the spiritual. And yet this can so easily, then, you know, anything can be taken then as representing this eternal self. We will not examine what we see or as representing this essence of mind that goes on. So often a very common trap, in my view, these days in practice is that we start to practice mindfulness. And then you have presence of mind, and then this presence of mind gets labelled as, well, this is eternal present moment, this perfect eternal present moment, or the mind enters a little bit into the present, or fully into the present, and then we get a sense for space. This is often what can happen. You get a sense of brightness of mind, which is the entering of the space element into the mind, the brightness there in the present moment. Then that becomes our eternal self and spirit, the manifestation of the spirit. Yeah, the Buddha is very clear to point out, well, actually all these things are in the world. Space is in the world. Space is appreciated by consciousness, which is impermanent. We can see this just when we fall asleep. We can see, well, it's not always there. Our mind becomes unconscious for one reason or another, sleep or any other reason. This human consciousness arising and ceasing. And then when we're conscious, then we're aware of this thing. And when we're not conscious, then we're not. So Buddha pointed all this out and said, well, but actually the mystery of the mind is that there is something that goes beyond all of this. There isn't unborn. There is something that doesn't depend on the world. Doesn't depend on latching on to something, even space or light or very subtle things, subtle and long-lasting things. You know, the danger in spiritual life is that our mind can latch on, an ordinary human consciousness latches on to something that's very stable and permanent, and then takes that to be the ineffable. And yet this is the way, this is going in the right direction. If we go towards these things, away from the things of time, and the things of the senses, towards things that are longer lasting, ineffable, stable, we put our minds onto these things, this is going in the right direction. This is the purpose of the meditation process, is to take our minds into this kind of realm. Buddhism, the kind of heavenly realms of light and space and openness and brightness. So even the Buddha himself made this mistake, seeing that this was in a sense just a more refined sense pleasure, and he made the mistake of thinking, well, this was a wrong direction. If I attach to these things are still just impermanent. And so he fell away from the path of refined meditation and turned to asceticism. Thinking that the way would be to find a way beyond the body, turning away from the body, kind of rejection of the physical existence in a way. A way of overcoming the mind's dependence on the physical. It's kind of opposite angle, isn't it? You go towards space, and light and space, you take the mind in that direction. And then when you see that this can't last and that the mind needs to return to the physical, we see the impermanence of the consciousness that places itself there. We see the act of volition that takes us to those spaces, and the dependence of that act of volition on the part of human consciousness. You see that all this dependent arising of these states, and then turning around and thinking, okay, well, maybe it's a matter of getting away from the body, turning away from the desires of the body, asceticism. He didn't find the way there either. It's like a pendulum. It's like very common for us as practitioners, how this pendulum of practice swings from one extreme to another, and we miss the middle ground. The Buddha wasn't an exception in this. He went from one extreme to the other as well in his spiritual practice, until he found the middle way. The middle way, which is not a rejection and not an indulgence either, just seeing. So there is no movement of the mind through craving to get away from. there is no becoming and no being and no rejection of being. Neither. If there is no birth, then there is no death. There's no birth into things one way or another. No movement of the mind one way or the other. And there's a stillness, coming to stillness. You see the one, the wanting to attach to things, hold to things, the sense of a need to hold on to something, or the wanting to get away from, withdraw, and then the middle way of detachment. So the Nibbana is detachment, that's all it is. It's not a getting away from, withdrawal from, or annihilation of. Neither is it a becoming something. So detached, the mind can exist in a state detached, rather than not attached and not withdrawn, but detached. To me, this is shown by the symbol of Anjali, whether this was the real intention of that gesture or not, of placing one's hands together out of respect. I don't know, I have no idea whether that was the origin of it, I suspect not. It is more to do with the etiquette of the warrior castes in the old days, that you're showing that you haven't got, you come in peace. Put your sword down, put your hands together and bow. You're putting yourself in a position of harmlessness, showing that you come in peace. Seems like more like that. And yet to me this gesture is a very good way of expressing this principle of detachment. So not clinging and not withdrawal, right? Not one or the other. This is where the Dhamma is. This is finding this place that takes us to the deathless, finding that. This light touch, say, a light touch on things, not holding, not withdrawing. So it's light touch that's the way. So from something that can seem quite philosophical, then we see that there's actually this can influence very much the kind of underlying movements of our minds towards or away from, into things or out of things. So often this is unseen, just the same as this middle way is unseen, middle ground of detachment, which is neither into something or away from something, neither grasping nor rejecting. Of letting go, but not letting go that is getting away from, withdrawing from. And this is something that needs to be experienced, you know, as the pendulum swings and gradually what the mainspring of our existence winds down, cools down, and the pendulum swings or more subtly and falls towards the middle. Middle of what is unborn, what is never born, and that which never dies. So I offer that for your reflection.